But that's right. So he was using the Cepheid variables, you know, to measure the distances in the universe. And Tony Z says, hey, they may have another use. Maybe they can be used for communication. Fabulous.
So it's really been a star-studded show.
It has been star-studded. And indeed, you know, just for your star-studding pleasure, the number of stars you can see tonight, if you live in a clear location in the night sky, is maybe 1,000, something like that. But in the Milky Way, a couple of 100 billion. You're missing out.
Thanks to our stellar production team, starring Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Also, financial support from Google, Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David, and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, and a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Stellar Job. You can find more Big Picture Science on iTunes. To access hundreds of episodes of Big Picture Science, be sure to go to our website and look at our archive, bigpicturescience.org. And while you're online, you might find and even download our Big Picture Science app. It's on iTunes, Android, and Windows 8.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer over-the-air radio because you can listen with more frequency, well, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show. Oh, and if you have a comment, a criticism, even praise, write us at bigpicturescience@seti.org.
You and are
so
listening
spat it out
to
at his, said, what is this?
Frisianary?
It is not Dom Perignon.
WHFR.FM.
Now this, Alvin and the this is real champagne, but of course it comes from my own vineyard. Funny
steps.
That I should mention the South of France, because
please,
it is there at
home
that I'm
waiting for the rim cycle.
Separate.
Alrighty, we're having an interesting start here. This is Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. Thank you so much for tuning in. And today's special guest is John, and I'm going to let John introduce himself. Let's see how your sound is.
Well, hi.
No. We need more.
You need more?
We need more.
You need more. She needs more, folks. She's working on it. I'm not sure what she's doing.
I'm not either. I make it up as I go.
Okay.
Okay, John.
Now,
please.
Now is my level adequate.
Yes, it's perfect. Thank
Very
you.
Very good. Thank you, Lynn. My name is John Reinecke. I'm president of the Michigan Antique Radio Club. And Lynn suggested I start with explaining how I got into radio. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting story. I think I became interested in radio and became an electrical engineer. Because when I was a little kid, you know how little kids are always intrigued by bright things? You hand a little kid a flashlight and they'll play with it for hours.
Yes.
Or a laser pointer and a little kid will play with it for hours. But I think I was intrigued because at that time, of course, old radios, well, they weren't old then, radios lit up inside. The vacuum tubes lit up inside.
Okay.
And as a kid, that just intrigued me, that the box that lit up inside could produce sound. Could produce intelligible music and all kinds of things. So that's how I think I got into it.
Did you take apart the first radio you were given?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And it's long gone.
Okay.
I took apart everything as a kid.
Okay.
And it was later in my life that I could figure out how to get them back together. But I did take everything apart. Watches, clocks, radios, old Lionel trains, and boy, I regret that one. I had my dad's Lionel train and took it all apart. I should save that. That's become collectible.
It didn't go back together.
No.
Okay.
But it was a lot of fun. But so growing up, I was always interested in electrical things. And I guess I've gone through my career trying to find something electrical to do for a living. I'm now retired. I'd like to note that I retired from an industry that didn't exist when I graduated from college.
Okay.
I'm a retired robotics engineer, retired from FANUC Robotics, and I started my career doing power plants and substations.
Okay.
In between, I did microwave, two-way radio. I did a stint in the telephone business, including the long-distance telephone business.
Okay.
I taught at Sinclair College. I owned a hardware store. So I've had a variety of things on my way to try to find out what I can do with my what I should be doing when I grow up.
Exactly.
I haven't figured that up yet.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still looking too.
So that's how I got interested in electronics. I started working for FANUC in then it was GMF Robotics.
Okay.
In 1985. And I ran into a guy who had in turn run into another chap at a flea market. And he said, did you want to go? I heard about this radio meet, this old radio meet. And it happened to be in Jackson, Michigan. So we went, and that was the spring of 1986. We went to the spring meet in Jackson. And boy, that was exciting. There must have been six people there with trunk sales selling old radios. And I kind of got hooked on old radios. Although I'd been interested in electronics. Through my high school years, I made a lot of spending money repairing radios, repairing televisions. A friend of mine and I built hi-fi consoles for people on commission. And shaking my head at that, because I can remember he had connections in Indiana and would come up with old dry sinks, and we would hack up the dry sinks to make them into console record players. And I hate to think about what some of those dry sinks might have been worth if we had hacked them up. Because in those days, they were just old.
Right.
Not collectible.
Wow. Do you find that old radios are like old cars, where they have parts that you understand and things you can repair, things you can take apart and put back together?
Well, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. In my interest, and that's the nice thing about radios, radio, of course, was the first mass communications, the first mass media. And when radio first came out, it was initially used for point-to-point communications. It was for sending telegrams. Mm-hmm. It cost 15 cents a word to send a message on Marconi in 1910.
Okay.
If you think about it,
that's expensive.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Figure factor 40 on inflation. So that was obviously a rich person's toy, and that's why Marconi made a lot of money.
Ah, okay.
But one of his employees by the name of Sarnoff figured out that the money to be made in radio was in broadcasting, where you had one transmitter and a whole bunch of receivers. And that's, of course, the start of radio.
Mm-hmm. How far back are we talking?
20s.
Okay.
Well, radio broadcasting, actually early radio AM broadcast, the first AM broadcast arguably was on Christmas Eve of 1906.
Okay.
When Fessenden did an AM broadcast. For his broadcast, he used an alternator to generate the radio frequency, which was barely above audio frequencies at that time, and a water-cooled carbon microphone between the alternator and his aerial,
okay,
what they called an antenna in those days.
You'll probably not meet anybody less mechanical than me. So when you're talking about an alternator, are you talking about apart from a car?
It's a big rotating machine that generated high frequency AC power that he radiated to an antenna. And I'm thinking, you have to go back, 1906, you're a seasoned radio operator on a ship at sea. Now let's think about 1906. Who would his audience be? It would be these operators at sea. And all you've heard is Morse code. You've heard Morse code is a series of buzzes, whistles, interesting spark gap noises. Mm-hmm. And all of what you hear is soprano and a violin. Think about it. I wish I could do that for the audience to think about the shock that would have been if you're sitting there standing watch for the few people who were standing watch on shipboard. Right. To hear a soprano and music.
Right.
The first commercial broadcasting on a regular basis, scheduled basis, was in 1920.
Okay.
With KDKA for Westinghouse.
So
in Pittsburgh.
Kind of a 1912 was the Titanic.
Correct.
So before that?
Before that, the first, it's interesting, the Titanic was the first ship to send SOS.
Mm-hmm.
As a distress. Before that, the standard call was CQD.
Okay.
And they would transmit CQD. SOS is a more distinctive tone on Morse code. But the the Titanic operators sat and alternated between CQD and SOS. It was the first time SOS had been sent. As a result of that catastrophe, the laws were changed to require that all ships at sea have a radio operator stay on duty 24 hours a day. Prior to that, and that's what had happened on the California, which was close enough to rescue people from the Titanic, the captain of the California stopped for the night because he knew he was traveling in iceberg territory.
Sure.
And only an idiot would steam full speed ahead through the North Atlantic that time of year.
Sure.
And he stopped for the night, and he told his radio operator he could go to bed. So he did.
Wow.
So although they were close enough to the Titanic, they could have rescued a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
They never got the call. It was the Lusitania that got the call. And the two Marconi operators transmitted until their feet got wet.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio station, the radio shack, was right behind the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So they continued transmitting literally until their feet got wet. And one went out one door, and one went out the other, and one made it, and one didn't.
Oh my.
In fact, the operator that survived, although his feet had gotten frozen, when they got to the Lusitania, he was the one that sent all of the messages back to New York and London because he was a more proficient operator than the one that was on the ship.
Wow.
So radio started as a emergency communications for ships,
mm-hmm.
and became a broadcast media in the 20s. Kind of interesting history. In the 20s, radios looked like laboratory instruments. And then somebody got the idea toward the end of the 20s that radios should be a piece of furniture. So you can start collecting radios, and there's with the collection interest, you can collect a radio as a piece of furniture. In the 30s, of course, there was the Depression, and radios went down and down in price and became more and more people wanted radios and could afford radios.
Okay.
And even if you couldn't afford a car, you could afford a radio. And that started as marketing differentiation in the 30s, the radios became styled. And Philco patented the famous cathedral radio shape.
Right.
Everybody thinks of an old radio, they think of a cathedral, a Philco Model 70, which was the cathedral shape that everybody
sure.
would recognize.
Right, exactly.
In the middle of the 30s, radios started to become actually an art object. And we'll get to your tale here in a little bit about the Spartan Nocturne. Spartan was in Jackson, Michigan at the time.
Oh.
And they made a series of very attractive radios. And they made a series of radios that were made with mirrored glass. They were made primarily in blue cobalt glass with a mirrored backing. They made them in a circular configuration, which was called a bluebird, which was maybe 14 inches in diameter, with a very nice chrome deco front trim on it, like an automobile grill almost, with a round dial in the middle and knobs.
Okay.
They also made what we collectors call a sled. It was a blue mirrored radio that was a table radio that had a chrome wraparound grill around the speaker on the left side.
Okay. And this was 30 styling or 20?
This is 30s.
This
is 30s. In the 20s, the early radios looked like great old laboratory instruments.
Right.
And then they started to look like massive pieces of furniture. And then they started to be suitable for putting on a table.
Right. Well, this sounds, with the glass, and it sounds very deco.
It is extremely deco.
Okay.
And those radios are extremely collectible. I wish I could afford one myself.
Mm, okay.
They've become quite valuable.
Ballpark, what are we talking?
A sled or a bluebird, a good one, will bring anywhere from $1,000 to $4,000, depending on how nice and how many people are bidding on it.
Right,
at a
of
given
course.
Auction, and how bad you want it.
Right.
But they're all very nice.
Wow.
From a collectible standpoint, in the 20s, Atwater Kent made what he called a breadboard. In those days, all the, they called it a breadboard because you mounted the components as if you were screwing them to a piece of wood like an old breadboard.
Okay.
And he made several radios again that were quite attractive if you're into the in the laboratory look. And those have become quite, those are still quite collectible.
Now, at the time, were those more affordable, I would think?
Those were, Atwater Kits were never affordable.
Oh?
They were always premium on performance.
Ah.
You spent a lot of money for the performance.
Okay.
Atwater Kent was a premium name.
Okay.
It should be noted that Atwater Kent in the 30s, the man, Atwater Kent, that's a man's name.
Okay.
He recognized where the radio industry was going and that he wasn't going to make the huge margins on it. So he simply folded up shop, moved to Southern California, and went into Wine Women and saw him. He just had enough sense to take his money and go enjoy himself.
Wow. Well, good
just,
for him.
Just in passing. But also in the 30s, radios were the first to adopt, were the first mass-produced, brightly colored plastic things.
Mm-hmm.
Those were low cost in the late 30s.
Okay.
And those late 30s, the plastic material is called Catalin. And those late 30s radios, which were inexpensive radios, have become very desirable as collector pieces now, in the present age, because they're pretty, they're colorful, they come in different colors, and you can try to collect all of the various shapes and colors and whatever. There's a catch when you're collecting a Catalin radio. The Catalin material was not stable.
Okay.
And they deteriorate with age. So to find a good one is tricky. And of course, they were cheap, so people didn't, you know,
didn't care.
If it fell off the table, it went into 1,000 pieces, and we get a new one.
Right, right. What is there a method to preserving that?
In the case of Catalin, you want to keep it at a moderate temperature,
mm-hmm.
and keep it out of sunlight.
Okay.
And keep your fingers crossed. when they mixed up that particular batch of that chemical that they were squirting into the mold, that they did it halfway decently.
Wow. Okay. Lots of ifs.
Lots of ifs. So that's why they're very collectible now and why people want them now.
Mm-hmm.
It makes something for us radio collectors if we want to restore a radio from even the 20s. In the case of the 20s radios, a lot of them used pot metal. Pot metal is a term used for metals that can be melted in a pot on your stove.
Oh.
And
fairly soft then.
Well, it was soft. It could be poured into a mold easily. It wasn't necessarily soft, but it could be poured into a mold easily. And some of the manufacturers would experiment with mixtures to pour into their molds. With a lot of it was cost, and a lot of it was just playing around, experimenting to get something that came out of a die-cast mold very nicely.
Okay.
And sometimes they mixed metals that made a great device, made a, you know, a great shaft holder for a shaft on a tuning knob, or primarily for tuning knobs and things like that in these radios. But that pot metal, these days, in the intervening decades, has deteriorated because the metals weren't stable and they'd corrode and swell and buckle, and there are people making reproductions of that, but it's a nuisance for those of us that restore it.
Sounds like it would be, right, okay.
And the plastic radios also introduced the Bakelite radios, and some of those persisted well into the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those moldings were very, very attractive.
Okay.
And Bakelite radios are much more affordable for a collector, and you can find something you like.
Mm-hmm. Colorful, I'm sure.
Well, Bakelite was primarily brown.
Really?
But a lot of them got painted.
Okay.
And there were other colorful plastic radios that also appear as colorful devices.
Right.
So people can collect radios because they're colorful.
Mm-hmm.
People can collect radios as I do because I'm an engineer. I'm interested in how my ancestor engineers figured out how to solve a problem. And it's interesting because, of course, a lot of times in solving radio problems, it was not so much solving a problem as it was patent avoidance. So you would try to come up with something that and evade the patents on it.
Just had to be a little bit different, right? Just
well,
a little bit?
Enough different, hopefully, that your lawyers could convince the judge that it was different. And consequently, through the 30s and the 20s and 30s, there was a lot of litigation over patents.
Okay.
So you wanted to have the patents too. So that also becomes a part of the history.
Okay. All right. So we're up through the early 60s at this point.
Into the 50s, into the 60s. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the 50s, there was a societal revolution that took place as a result of, first, transistor radios. Mm-hmm. The first transistor radio produced was produced in Indianapolis, Indiana, for the 1954 Christmas season.
Oh, okay.
It was a $60 toy, but it would fit in your pocket.
Yes, yeah.
And it started a revolution. Those Regency radios are, those first TR1, transistor radio ones, Regency radios, are highly collectible. And in the case of Regency, Regency hung around for years after they made transistor radios. They did police scanners, and you may have seen a Regency police scanner. Not so collectible, but interesting. Mm-hmm. Regency is, it's a historical trivia, I guess, in this case. Regency was the first to market a transistor radio. And at the time, they had an opportunity to invest in a fledgling semiconductor house in Dallas, Texas. But because they were so conservative in their management, they weren't going to waste their money investing in a fly-by-night Texas outfit called Texas Instruments.
Wow.
Because they made transistors.
Right, right.
But they weren't going to invest in it, which I see, you know, had they invested in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, another...
Woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Woulda, shoulda, coulda. So transistor radios, of course, became all the rage because now you could carry music around in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was Revolution 1. Revolution 2 in the late 50s into the 60s was the advent of FM. FM had been around since the 30s.
Okay.
Armstrong invented it and patented it in 34. And it's interesting at that time because he worked for Sarnoff at RCA at the time.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Sarnoff was not interested in investing in FM. He was putting all of his money in television. And Armstrong and Sarnoff came to what became a very acrimonious separation. And Armstrong went off to form the Yankee Network, which is the first series of FM broadcast stations.
Okay.
And if you're on the East Coast, you remembered the Yankee Network, and nobody else would.
Okay.
And Sarnoff went off to do television.
Okay.
So then that was a very ugly series of countersuits and lawsuits and very bad feelings back that persisted into the 50s until Armstrong committed suicide.
Oh, my.
Leaving his widow, a very rich widow, because she finally won on all the patent battles.
Okay.
But at any rate, the FM broadcasting came out, and FM, of course, offered high-quality sound. And in late 61, early 1962, FM offered stereo. And then everybody wanted an FM radio.
Okay.
And that's when FM broadcasting became the music broadcasting, and AM started moving away from music into talk and sports and news, and started evolving to where we are now in terms of broadcasting.
Okay.
So it's just all very interesting as to how that evolved.
Right, right. We talked about the style of the case, if you will, the box of the radio itself. What were we hearing in the 20s? You were talking about now we're listening to FM music, and we have stereo sound, and AM has news and news and sports games and what have you. But what were we hearing?
In the 20s, that's interesting because nobody knew what radio was for. So it was going to be for education. So there were colleges had stations, which of course people were learning how to do radio. So they would broadcast educational material. And we had to enrichen people, so we'd transmit symphonies. And this was all kind of on an ad hoc basis.
Okay.
There were early disc jockeys. They would play records. What can I do with radio? Well, I can play records.
Okay.
And of course I can broadcast political results. I can broadcast news. I can broadcast fights, which was a big deal. Boxing was a big deal, mm-hmm. and you could broadcast fights. And of course, that would be live. Mm-hmm. It's just evolved. The first broadcast, the first scheduled, we were mentioning this before, when I first came in to talk to you, mm-hmm. the first broadcast, regularly scheduled network broadcast program was Amos and Andy. And whatever you might think about Amos and Andy and two white guys in blackface
right.
playing Amos and Andy, they were funny mm-hmm. and they were popular. And then, of course, a number of other radio programs started coming along, involving the Lone Ranger and soap operas. And we call them soap operas because they were always sponsored by soap companies mm-hmm. for the
women listeners.
For the housewives.
Sure.
Because in those days, women were housewives.
That's right.
And you broadcast for the housewives on the radio.
Okay.
And The Shadow and all kinds of very interesting and creative shows. Mm-hmm. I would highly recommend, if you haven't listened to old radio programs, they're available on the web these days, that you go back and listen to some of them, because some of them are remarkably well done.
We regularly broadcast on Thursdays Boston Blackie.
Okay.
And we have a whole series of those. I think those are 1940s.
30s and 40s.
30s yeah, and 40s. 40s. Okay, yeah.
Okay. And I remember at the time, several years ago, my younger high school son asked me, how could War of the Worlds cause a panic? The famous 1938 Orson Welles, mm-hmm. Cause a panic. Well, there's an interesting tidbit that would help explain that, because in these days, we channel surf. Well, that's not new. In the 30s, radios had push-button tuning. And in 1938, the Mercury Theater, which did War of the Worlds, played opposite the Chase and Sanborn Hour. Chase and Sanborn Hour always opened with the Charlie McCarthy monologue, which of course was funny. Mm-hmm. So people would tune in to Chase and Sanborn Hour, listen to the Charlie McCarthy monologue, enjoy it, and then switch over to the Mercury Theater. Now, if you switched over to the Mercury Theater on that particular evening, mm-hmm. you would have missed all of the introduction, and you would have walked into what sounded like a on-scene Martian invasion.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if you thought about it, all the things you were hearing on the radio couldn't have possibly happened in a 20-minute span. But people didn't, mm-hmm. and it was so well done that it caused a panic.
Well, 1938, things were starting to happen, too, in Europe.
Things were starting to happen in Europe.
And, you know, the world was uncertain. We think it's uncertain now. It was uncertain then.
Yes, it was. And a Martian invasion just played right into everybody's fears. So it's an interesting tidbit, which is mm-hmm. why Orson Welles was greeted by the police pretty close to show. And possibly one of the best radio stunts ever.
Oh my gosh, yes.
On the air.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so people can collect old radio programs. You can collect radios because you're interested in them from a styling standpoint, because you like deco things. There are people now who are collecting, and everybody calls them mid-century modern, the radios from the 50s. Because again, aesthetically, they're very interesting. They're very reasonable in price to collect now, particularly if you're willing to work on them, and they're fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of collecting, you have some fabulous adventures when you go collecting radios, or collecting anything, but collecting radios has the advantage if you don't have to spend a fortune.
Okay.
And if you like to tinker, and I like to tinker, you can work on a radio. It's something that doesn't argue with you. it's just you and the radio and your wits against what's happened to it in the intervening decades since it was new.
Right.
But you had mentioned the tale of the that's in our flyer.
Right, and I put that out on the webpage, too.
On the webpage of the Spartan Knock.
Right, so now you have to tell.
Now
because
I have to tell people.
The answer is today.
the tale of the Spartan Nocturne. The Spartan Nocturne was a one of these nice mirrored mirrored glass radios.
Okay.
It was designed for hotel lobbies.
Oh, okay.
And conspicuous public places because the radio was a good
3.5-4 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. It was a circular face, about 4.5 feet in diameter. Intense, deep cobalt blue.
Okay.
And they're very striking even today because you can't get that intense cobalt blue glass these days. And it's just a wonderful deep blue glass. Now they made them in other colors, but it was a deep. This particular one was deep glass, and the front had this marvelous vertical chrome trim on it with the dial in it. Now Spartan put a very good radio in that very attractive case, and we should mention from an audio quality standpoint, radios of the 30s still sound. When they're properly restored, still sound very good. There's no apologies required for the sound. Don't let anybody kid you. Your Bluetooth receiver isn't going to sound any better, honest, than a 30s vintage radio.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
they sounded very good, and mm-hmm. they were designed for hotel lobbies. They didn't make a lot of them. They sold for $360 in 1936.
That's a lot.
You could buy a Ford for $450.
Right, okay.
So you're almost three-quarters the price of an automobile for this radio.
Mm-hmm.
And these days, they are highly desirable as collectors, and a good one will bring between $70,000 and $80,000.
Wow.
In terms of collectability.
Wow.
I'm told Barbra Streisand has two of them.
Okay.
And there's maybe a dozen or so known to survive. They didn't make a lot of them because they were extremely expensive.
Right.
So that's the Nocturne is a highly desirable collector's radio.
You said it was designed for lobbies
because it was so large,
right? And what kind of what are we talking about size wise? So far as the dimensions go, that was
well, if you can imagine a circle about 4 feet in diameter,
mm-hmm.
and it would sit off the wall maybe 18 inches.
Okay,
so you're taking up a fair chunk of your living room if you're putting it in your living room.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So that's the background on the Nocturne.
Okay.
A few years ago, our webmaster got a call from a lady in Okemos.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she thought it was a valuable radio, and she thought she wanted to sell it. She didn't want it anymore. And our webmaster called our friend Bruce Tanner, who lives in Okemos, to go check it out, go talk to her, mm-hmm. see what it was. And it turned out to be a Nocturne. Now, the tale with this particular Nocturne is that when they came out, her husband and a bunch of his friends, apparently it was like six of them, drove to the plant, the manufacturing plant in Jackson, and four of the guys bought Nocturnes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her husband at the time couldn't afford it. But a couple of years later, he managed to save up enough money, and he too bought a Nocturne. And as long as her husband was alive, the Nocturne sat in their living room. And she despised it. Because if you sat in your living room, all anybody did was stare at the radio. Is how she put it. Because it was so imposing.
Right.
Not everybody's living room could accommodate such a large thing.
Right, like a gravity furnace takes up your basement.
Like a gravity furnace takes up, and this was gravity too, man. Everybody's eyes are drawn to this. You're trying to carry on a conversation, and people are constantly staring at the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't like that. So when her husband died, she took it out and left it in the barn. She had hauled it out to the barn. And there it sat for probably 30 years. Unfortunately, the barn roof leaked. Barns have mice. So the combination of the roof leaking and the mice weren't altogether kind to it.
Sure.
So the front of it got rusty. The the weather conditions separated the mirroring from the glass, the temperature extremes, the moisture, the nastiness from the weather.
Right.
And, of course, the mouse droppings don't help.
No. I imagine they chewed some wires, too, in the process.
Actually, it wasn't too bad in that respect.
Really?
Okay. When we were pleased to find that.
Yes.
So when Bruce found it, he explained to her that, yes, this is a valuable radio. You don't want to throw this away.
Exactly.
And I think at the time he could have offered her $1,000, and she would have been delighted, and he would have been also delighted.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, no, I could offer you that, but you should bring it to our auction at Extravaganza, which is our big summer meet. And, okay, I'll take the radio to Extravaganza. I'll put it in the auction.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce agreed that he would take care of getting it, schlepping it from her barn to the meet.
Right.
Nervous as all get out, because you've got this very valuable piece of spotless glass. Now, the glass had been weathered off, but it wasn't chipped or scratched or cracked. It was all there.
Okay.
And it was all there but one knob, and we never found the one knob, which are available as reproductions. But otherwise, it was absolutely complete.
Right.
So she brought it to our auction, and I had the pleasure of sitting or standing where I could see her face as the bidding went up. And we went from like six bidders until the price got to about $12,000. And then it went down to three bidders, and then it went down to, well, it was still at the end. It was four bidders through down to three bidders at the end. And the final bid was $34,000.
Wow.
And the expression on her face was, well, priceless.
Sure. despised radio.
This despised radio. And she was worried about taxes and everything
at that point. Sure.
Because it constituted a significant part of her income for that year. So it was a very happy tale.
Yes. Yes.
We do a thing at our radio meets we call Radio Rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where we invite people in to get an evaluation of the radio. And a lot of people are bringing in what they hope are valuable radios. And let's be honest, folks, they're not.
Okay.
You know, and it's a $5 or $10 radio in that condition. That's fine. And that's fine. If mm-hmm. you like it, family piece, we can direct you to somebody who can fix it for you. But please understand it's not valuable.
Right.
But every once in a while, you get an exception. For example, we've had people bring in Mickey Mouse radios. Now, those were made by Emerson in the 30s.
Oh.
And they were made in the, like, 1935, 36 time frame when Mickey Mouse was still kind of new.
Sure.
And it had Mickey on them. And they were, it's a rep wood. The material was essentially compressed paper mache. So they weren't, we're talking about a $9, $10 radio at the time. It was a very inexpensive radio. It was a child's radio, mm-hmm. kid's radio, a toy. And consequently, again, they were cheap. People didn't keep them. Bad things happen to paper mache when it's exposed to moisture. So a good one will bring north of a grand.
Wow. Wow.
They also did the Snow White one.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Seven Dwarfs. And again, very collectible.
And what kind of size are those? What?
They're table radios. They're smaller than a bread box.
Okay.
I mean, they're not far removed in size from a modern table radio.
Sure.
9 inches by 5 inches by 4 inches. They're not big, not huge. They're very attractive. You could have a bunch of them on shelves and enjoy them, and people do.
And it would be a perfect fit for a child's room, too, is what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, except you don't want the kid to play with it.
Well, no, not now.
Not now.
Maybe back in the 30s, but not
maybe
now.
Back in the 30s. So that was Hopalong Cassidy radios were made by Arvin in the late 40s, early 50s. And these were very cheap radios. They were sold as being shatterproof because they were in a steel box. Now, from a modern standpoint, if you want to collect a hobby radio, and you can find hobby radios, they're very collectible, and again, very several hundred dollars if you find a good one. As a radio, it's a crummy radio, but it was a kid's toy. But I should put, they came with a safety caution. And that is that one side of the line was connected to the chassis. The chassis was in a steel box. Don't use this anywhere near the bathroom or sink or any water because they're an enormous shock hazard.
Oh, my gosh.
the standards for safety these days are much more stringent.
Sure.
And
yeah.
And literally one side of that case was connected to the line. So one is connected to one of those prongs on the that you plugged in. So if you, it's a little like sticking your finger in the outlet.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
So there are some cautions that go with old radios, too. The ones in Bakelite cases and wooden cases are pretty safe.
Okay.
But the
metal
cases,
yeah.
Beware.
Yeah. They always say not to put the radio in the bathtub, so it's...
Or in the bathroom.
Or in the bathroom in this
or in
case.
A lot of people had them in their kitchen. You don't want it too close to the kitchen sink either.
Oh, my gosh. And it probably got figured out the hard way, I'm thinking.
Well, yeah, it was unfortunate for a lot of people.
Tell us, we are, this hour is going by so quickly. Tell us about the club. Tell us about the Antique Radio Club.
Okay, the Antique Radio Club in the mid-80s, or early part of the 80s, mid-80s, a lot of people were discovering old radios.
Okay.
And there were old radio clubs forming around the country, specifically intending to collect old radios. Now, some of these people were interested in the pioneering pieces, the Marconis, the stuff that dates back to the turn of the 20th century, not the turn of the 21st, but the 100 plus years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there was interest in preserving these items and in understanding these items and in just fun sometimes getting them working, part of it. So there was a interest in collecting in the mid-80s. And there was enough interest at that time that there were people who were doing it for as a business because you could actually flip old radios. You still can. But then it was, if you could buy, you could find one in a secondhand store, in a Goodwill store, Salvation Army. You could get it for a couple of bucks, fix it up, and sell it for a couple of $100. And it was people were doing it as a business. At any rate, several very interested people gathered in 85 at the Dillon Inn and founded the Michigan Antique Radio Club in October of 85.
Okay, and where is that?
Dillon Inn's on the west side of Lansing.
Okay.
And it's no longer the Dillon Inn. It's now, whatever. It's still there.
Okay.
And I can remember myself going to the first extravaganza in 86, and there must have been a dozen people there. And as it turns out, Brace Beamer's nephew was speaking at that extravaganza, and he was telling about his life with Brace, and that room was so packed I think the fire marshal would have had a fitniption if he'd seen how many people were in there to hear him. And I remember the crowd, and I remember that Brace, I think, actually thought he was the Lone Ranger.
Explain to the listeners who this is we're talking
Brace
about.
Brace Beamer was the radio voice of the Lone Ranger, and not to be confused with the television version that most of us remember,
mm-hmm.
But he was the radio voice of the Lone Ranger. So we've had, and of course the Lone Ranger was so successful that that was produced here in Detroit, that it spun off other radio series from the Lone Ranger. The production company spun off other series. Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, some of us will remember as kids listening to Sergeant Preston with his dog King, on you Huskies, yes, and the Lone Ranger's nephew, the Green Hornet, also was spun off.
Okay,
and that's just an interesting tidbit of radio history,
which moved forward into television.
Which moved into television.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and a number of radio programs moved to television. My Favorite Husband moved to television.
I don't know that name.
My Favorite Husband starred Lucille Ball.
Oh.
When it made it to television, they called it I Love Lucy.
Okay. All right.
So that moved over to television.
Okay.
The Lone Ranger moved over to television. Amos and Andy moved over to television without as much success. It mm-hmm. never worked as well on TV as it did on the radio.
I think that was the imagination of what you were hearing.
Correct.
And making your own theater of the mind.
The theater of the mind.
Absolutely, yeah.
There was a radio program called Leitingen versus the Ants. And if you can find a copy of Leitingen versus the Ants, I guarantee, as an adult, in the dark, it'll raise the hair on the back of your neck. Even now.
Okay.
Because your imagination is far worse than anything you could do with special effects or CGI. It's, again, the theater of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Tell us about the, I have a couple things I definitely want to get in. If I want to find one of these antique radios, you had made mention of some secondhand shops, which I could attempt to find something. What about a more modern store? Do modern stores carry antique radios, or should I go to a swap meet?
If you want to find an antique radio, you're going to want to come to one of our swap meets.
Okay.
Like our one coming up this Saturday. I'll get in that plug. At the Caustic Center, starting at 9 a.m., 9 till about 2. If you want the best choices, come early.
Okay.
You'll meet people. That's a good place to get a radio. You can find radios at Goodwill, Salvation Army from time to time. You can find them in antique stores. The ones in antique stores aren't going to be cheap.
Sure.
We're the we are, frankly, our meats of the wholesale gathering for it. We're the place that the antique shops shop.
Okay. And you mentioned working out of 6 trunks at one of your early meets.
Yeah, the early meets were outside in trunks.
Right.
We had one here. We used to meet at the Little Professor Bookstore here at Dearborn.
Sure.
And the last one of those I remember, it frickin' poured rain. It just poured. It was nasty. It was unpleasant. It was that point that we decided as a club to find our way indoors. Now all of our meets are held indoors. Our extravaganza is at the Expo Center in Kalamazoo, which is a wonderful facility, and it's air conditioned, and it's out of the heat, and out of the sun, and out of the rain, and out of the... So we moved inside from trunk sales. There are people who miss trunk sales, but not very much, particularly on a rainy spring day.
So how many vendors, if you will, are we looking at Saturday?
This coming Saturday, maybe 60.
Okay.
I don't know what the attendance is right at the moment, how many people have signed up, but it's in the order of about 60 vendors will be there.
Okay.
Selling all kinds of stuff.
And do you find that, I know with record shows and things, you may find people coming in from across the country.
At this meet, people will come from around the state of Michigan, certainly.
Okay.
We get people from as far away as Cleveland, Dayton, Columbus, Indianapolis. So people will drive a few hours to get to this meet. Mm-hmm. Our meet in July at the Expo Center, we get people as far away as Australia come in to see it.
Okay.
Because it's known internationally as well as nationally.
Okay. And a lot of passion.
Yeah, and
a lot of passion.
Yeah, I can imagine coming from New Zealand to buy a radio.
You're right.
And then figure out how to get it the overhead bin to get it home.
Yes. Okay, so this coming Saturday, which is January 16th, 9 a.m. until 2 p.m., we're looking at the Caustic Center, which is in Farmington Hills.
It's on Farmington Hills, on 11 mile between Middle Belt and Inkster. It's about halfway between Middle Belt and Inkster on the north side of the road.
Okay.
And it's back off the road a bit, so keep your eyes open. There is a nice sign out front.
But, that's a good thing.
and nice plantings and bushes and a nice big driveway, but do keep an eye out because it's way back off the road.
Okay. All right. And it's out of the snow.
And it'll be out of the snow. And if it's a snowy day, yes, we'll still be out of the snow.
Sure. and it says on the flyer, vintage radios, hi-fi stereo equipment, along with televisions, calculator, computer games, all for sale by owners.
All by owners. Yeah, I have no idea what people will bring.
Okay.
I have no control over that. We have found that there are a number of people who will bring stuff to sell, and there is an interest in calculators, to my amazement. I don't think there's much of a market yet in used iPods, but again, that's
could happen.
My iPod Nano, I'm sure it is now a collector piece.
Okay. Well, I remember the days when everybody had to have a TI handheld calculator.
And those do occasionally turn up. And what we find interesting in this group is that people are collecting records these days. People have rediscovered vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
We already knew that vinyl sounded good. us old guys already knew that vinyl really does sound good. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of people who are finding it. And old vintage 60s and 70s record changers and record turntables, frankly, are a lot better made than modern ones.
Okay.
And they are repairable. We have a couple of people in the group that do repair them, and they do sound good, and they're much more durable. And you're welcome to come look, because there will be some there, I know, because I know we have a couple of radio collectors who are also interested in hi-fi and stereo.
Okay.
And there'll be tube-type audio equipment, and musicians still like to use tube-type amplifiers. And tubes are still manufactured for those. A lot of the old radio tubes, of course, haven't been made for decades. But the interesting thing about tubes is, of course, to make tubes, when you got the equipment set up to make them, they were automated, of course, in the 50s. To set up the equipment took quite a bit of effort. And once you had it set up, you wanted to run them in batches of at least 10 or 15,000. So tubes were made in huge quantities, and people are still mining those stocks of tubes.
Okay.
And of course, they haven't been made for 50 years, so eventually they will disappear. But right at the moment, there are a number of people who collect tubes and sell tubes back and forth.
Amazing.
And in fact, there are some tubes that are highly desirable and bring big bucks from audio collectors.
Okay.
Or audiophiles.
Wow. Let's talk about, I have stuff in my basement, my garage, what have you, and I would like to set up a table. How do I do that?
Okay, in terms of that, we have our contact information, and I think you've put that on the website. I don't know if you have or not.
I will if I didn't.
Oh, thank you. we'll have contact information, and you can get a table. We also have what we call a silent auction. If you only have one or two things, you could bring it in if you want to sell it. You can put it in the silent auction, and it's a classic silent auction where people bid with a pencil until a time is up, and then we turn the sheets over and settle with the buyers and sellers. So you could sell something in the silent auction, and that is your liability is limited to 10%. We get 10% commission, plus your $5 admission.
Okay.
So you come in for $5, and then you can put it in. We get a 10% commission.
Okay.
And to a limit of $75. So if you'd happen to sell something for $1,000, we only get $75.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow.
So it could be quite a bargain for an auction. We have had people bring in radios at this meet that we're talking about coming up. A couple of years ago, we had a lady bring in one of those plastic radios from the 30s. And we held an ad hoc impromptu auction because she wanted to sell it. We held a live auction. And she was very happy to walk out with 15 $100 bills. And the expression, again, on her face was priceless, that somebody would hand her 15 nice, crisp $100 bills for that radio. Now, honestly, most of them are going to be lucky to bring 10 or 15, but there are a few exceptions. But yes, you can. If you've got a basement full of stuff, we try to find somebody. We'll find somebody to come take a look at it for you, one way or the other.
Okay.
There are a few club members who will buy lots, and those are the people who have barns and warehouses and places to park stuff and sort through it, and they'll buy stuff as a lot. Obviously, if you want top dollar, sell it on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's top dollar and top aggravation for the seller.
Right, right.
And if you sell it as a point out to people, if you're selling a lot, a barn full of stuff, a garage full of stuff, a basement full of stuff, you're not going to get top dollar for it because the person buying it is taking the risk of sorting through it and finding what might be valuable in there.
Exactly.
And what in there might be what we call plink bait.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you set a bunch of stuff on the fence rail and plink it off with a .22.
Okay.
So.
some of that, the history just doesn't merit anything.
Yeah, and we point out to people, because it's rare, doesn't necessarily make it valuable. Now, I like to collect. I have a few rare pieces in my collection. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of laboratory or production prototypes. And the production prototypes are very interesting, but I'd be lucky to get a quarter for a couple of them.
Sure. Okay.
And I guarantee there's only one of them. But That doesn't make it valuable.
Oh, my gosh. Best way to get information. I see two different addresses here.
www.thevee.org or michiganantiqueradioclub.org.
Okay. And those will...
Those will take you to our website.
And I have been to the website, and there's a lot of information out there, pictures and all kinds of interesting tidbits.
Tidbits.
Okay. And so you're having the expo two times per year then?
Right at the moment, we're doing it twice a year.
Okay.
We are meeting in this coming July. Well, we have this one coming up Saturday, of course, here
right.
at Farmington Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And then our meeting in July is in Kalamazoo. That's the weekend after the 4th of July.
Okay.
7, 8, 9, I have to think.
Okay.
And that is we start on Friday morning there. So it's a two-day affair. We're Friday morning, Saturday, all day Friday, all day Saturday.
Wow.
We do, on Friday, we will do a silent auction and a live auction
mm-hmm.
with an auctioneer. And on Saturday, Saturday we do the silent auction. Friday we do the live auction. Saturday we do a silent auction. Also on Saturday we do what we call our donation auction, or what we refer to as our goodbye affair, where people donate stuff to the club and we auction it off and the proceeds go to the club. And it's a good way to pick up some incredible bargains.
Sure.
And we'll in fact do a donation auction sale at our meet on Saturday as well. That's
okay.
how we close the meet is with the donation auction.
Right.
And you can pick up actually some pretty neat stuff. And if you want project stuff, parts, radios, and even then I've seen some really good radios go in the donation auction.
Mm-hmm. Wow. About how many visitors do you have? How many guests come to, or is it kind of a mixed bag where I might come in as a guest, but by the way, I have this radio under my arm.
You can come in with $5 get you in the door, and you
okay.
bring a radio. We'll tell you whether it's worth anything or not,
okay.
or a little bit of history on the radio, how old it is, if nothing else, and you can shop around. We typically get 400 to 500 people here.
Okay. That's a very good crowd.
At this meet.
Yeah.
At Extravaganza, we'll top 1,000 for the 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get 400 or 500 a day.
Wow.
And then the Expo Center is huge, so that's
right.
wonderful.
Right.
And this is a nice big facility here. It's very it's very nice inside, easy to get to.
And I'm thinking you shared your history early this hour regarding how you kind of got there. But I'm sure everybody has their own story of I had this radio as a kid. My grandpa gave me this radio, whatever it might be. And it just kind of sparks an interest.
Or sparks an interest
yeah.
is correct. And
wow.
some people get into the radio business, as you have.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I would have gotten into it from a technical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Well, John, thank you so much. This has been very informative. The hour flew by. And
I guess it did, if we're there.
We're there. But thanks again so much. And then, again, what's the best way for someone to find out about participating at some level on Saturday? What's the best way to do that?
You could go to the website and see how to find us. We've got a couple of contacts on the website. They can call me.
Okay.
I'm at 248-626-4895.
Okay.
And they could call Rob, who's in charge of the meet.
Okay.
And I think we may have another number there.
Number for Rob is 248-399-2149.
Thank you.
Email?
And email, you could, I would check with the website on
okay,
that.
All right.
And then it'll be forwarded from there.
Oh, okay. And I do have one on the flyer, and that's MURRELLR at Ameritech.net.
And that's Rob.
So yeah, that's Rob.
So he'll get you from there.
Oh, this has been interesting. So much. I looked at the site. I had a couple ideas of where this would go. Got into that great discussion about the Titanic. So this has been a phenomenal hour. So, John, thank you so much. Any parting words?
See you Saturday morning.
Excellent.
I'll be happy to see you Saturday morning.
Right. And this is Lynn, your host of Impact, heard on the second Tuesday of the month at 1 o'clock, right here on WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. Impact is a show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. John, I think you're doing that.
Thank you.
In a lot of ways. Okay. Thanks so much for being part of Impact.
We help, you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford College in Dearborn, Michigan is a comprehensive public college serving about 18,000 students each year in Southeast Michigan. HFC is dedicated to preparing students for the rapidly changing workplace in today's world by offering more than 100 associate degree and university transfer programs. HFC also specializes in customized workforce development training for business and industry. Since its founding in 1938, HFC has been the gateway to higher education for thousands of students who seek an affordable, high-quality post-secondary education. To learn more about what HFC has to offer, please visit us at www.hfcc.edu or you can call the campus office at 1-800-585-HFCC. Your future begins now, and it begins right here at Henry Ford College.
Hi, this is Pat Frisco with a message that Spirits Rejoice enters its 21st year on the air. Continuing the sounds of creative improvised music every Tuesday from 6 until 10 p.m. on this radio station, WHFR Dearborn.
The night sky is beautiful, but stars do more than attractively twinkle.
They can teach us about other celestial phenomena.
For example, that there's a black hole in the center of our galaxy and what it weighs.
The size of that black hole is several million times the mass of our sun.
But starlight can also play tricks. According to one astronomer, one of the biggest exoplanet discoveries, possibly habitable worlds, may have been a mirage.
So both of the planets in the Gliese 581 system that were considered to be potentially habitable unfortunately don't exist.
Plus, a dangerous spike in ultraviolet radiation sounds the alarm about a thinning ozone layer.
Also, how stars guided Polynesian sailors as they colonized the Pacific.
And you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. How do you like that mix, huh? Hey, you're at the Malt Shop with Daddy G, here on WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm, the station making waves, and we're going back to the 50s and the 60s. So, grab your favorite squeeze, hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, and head on down to the Malt Shop. And here we are, back in the 50s.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on.